welcome to VBAC Birth Stories, a podcast where Australians share their journey to a vaginal birth after cesarean.
We are a safe haven for women to share their own VBAC journeys and through these personal experiences, educate and empower listeners.
I'm your host, Mel.
And I'm your host, Steph. And this is VBAC Birth Stories.
Hi everyone, we hope that you're keeping well this Easter long weekend. Today we'll be bringing you a bonus episode where we speak with Hazel Keedle, who is a PhD candidate, a lecturer and academic course advisor in the School of Nursing and Midwifery at Western Sydney University. Hazel's passion for VBAC stemmed from her own personal experience of having a VBAC only 14 months after her primary caesarean. After undertaking a master's honours thesis on why women have a VBAC at home, she became inspired to do her PhD, which looks at women's experiences of planning a VBAC in Australia. She's currently in the last phase of this research, and we hope that you enjoy today's episode and find some useful information to assist you on your personal journey and to hear from the woman at the forefront of VBAC research in Australia.
Thanks so much, Hazel, for joining us today. We really appreciate you taking the time to chat to us and you being our first guest speaker on our podcast. We're really grateful. We know that you've done a lot of research in VBAC and you're passionate about it. So we'd like to start by asking you what personally drew you to VBAC research.
Well, I was a nurse and then I qualified as a midwife and I planned to have my first baby at home. I got pregnant in my new grad year and I had a home birth midwife and I was all set for that, but it wasn't a very easy pregnancy. I had pneumonia at 34 weeks. He was breech. And then he ended up being a transfer into hospital where there was no other option but to have a cesarean. I knew that it was quite distressing because he was a breech and I knew they wouldn't give me an option back then. This is like 12 years ago. So that was a cesarean and I got very sick afterwards too. I got endometritis, so I got an infection in the inside of the uterus, which I was back in hospital for. So it was really the most hospitalized home birth you could get, really. I didn't do too well emotionally afterwards either. I remember waking up in the night, holding him and just going, how do I know you're mine? I wasn't there. I didn't see, you know, I was awake, but I hadn't gone through that process and I was surprised at how much it affected me actually. But then I unplanned, got pregnant really quickly. He was about 6 months old, and I'm thinking, why are my nipples sore again? Great laugh. And I told a friend of mine, and she's like, oh, don't worry, you're just really stressed. And I'm like, okay. And I was at a chemist, and there was some pregnancy tests on sale, so I thought, oh, I might just check. And I was pregnant, and I was already 2 months pregnant by that point. I hadn't realized. So I got pregnant really quickly. And that, I then obviously did the maths and it was only going to be about 14 months in between cesarean and then the next birth. And I read a really good book, which is very old in its data, but The Silent Knife. I read that and then I spent a weekend, as privileged as I can be because I know how to access data, reading about the risks of having a VBAC with a short interpregnancy interval. And the rate was, of the uterine rupture rate was increased. Something like 2.7%, but then that was compared to less than 1% than it would be if it was more than, you know, like 3 years or something. So I was a bit concerned and I said to my husband, that's it, I can't do this. No one's going to support me to have a VBAC after only 14 months. And, you know, the risk is 2.7%. So he quickly was very logical and said to me, yeah, but that gives you an over 97% chance of that not happening. I'm like, oh yeah, that's true. So then I just kind of avoided all antenatal care and did my own fetal heart rates, got someone to do my blood pressure every now and then because I was still working. I had to go back to work because I was having these babies so close together so I could get my maternity pay. I had to go back to work earlier. And then I planned to have a VBAC at home. But when I went into, I had quite a long early labor. And during that early labor, my doula had to go to somebody else. And my midwife couldn't attend. She was a friend more than not actual private midwife. She couldn't attend because of family issues. So I was suddenly at home. Things were ramping up. And I was planning this VBAC and I didn't feel, because I'm such an, you know, thinker as a midwife too, yes. I didn't feel confident doing this as a free birth. So the local hospital I know wouldn't support me. So I rang up the hospital down the road and said, look, I'm unbooked. I'm a planned VBAC. I'm coming in. And I turned up. I was already 4 centimetres dilated and I got there about 9 or 10 in the morning. All day they said to me, by 4 o'clock we're taking you for a repeat cesarean. We don't really support what you're doing, but we're taking you at 4 o'clock for your repeat cesarean. And she was born dead on 4 o'clock through my vagina.
Awesome.
And it was a real challenge. It's not easy being in labor anyway, but it wasn't easy with a doctor that just kept coming in and making comments like I was too loud or I was too quiet or the CTG wasn't right. Or it was just a real challenge. I was connected to everything. I was told during a vaginal examination by a midwife, you know, we had a uterine rupture recently and a baby died. I thought, that's not the best time to tell me. But unfortunately, I knew about the case. I said, yes, but that's because you pumped her full of Cinto. And so then she kept quiet. But when I look back at that experience, I mean, I felt amazing. I felt like it didn't matter if I'd been on the moon, at home, in a hospital. The fact that she came through my vagina was the biggest thing ever. And I felt amazing. And I still do. And she's 11 now. But it made me reflect. It made me think, you know what, if I had such a hard time and I was a midwife and I knew how to access information and I could safely avoid antenatal care because I could do my own screening, you know, how can anyone else achieve a VBAC? Like, how is it even possible to do that in both the home or in a hospital environment? I did bump into, or I met Professor Hannah Darling at a community event where I shared my VBAC story. And she said to me, you need to do research on this. And so my babies were very young still at that point. So it took another year of emails from her until I went, okay, fine, I'll do it. And even then my baby was only, she would have only been about 3. So although I've had 2 babies, I actually have raised 5 children because my husband came with as the full-time carer of 3. So I had a house of 5 children under 10.
Oh, wow.
So it was a bit nuts. And then I thought, well, why not? I'll do research on top of all of that as well while still working. and that's kind of been my life ever since, really, work and study and produce research. I didn't know if I'd like the research process, but once I started doing it, I did a master's honours, and that's when I looked at women who planned a VBAC at home. And I loved the process. I just absolutely loved the process of doing research and then seeing it get out to the community, and publishing was something I really enjoyed doing. So I got well and truly hooked onto research, and the VBAC fight in my belly never left. Like, and I'm still on fire from it. And so, you know, I've done it. I'm interested in it from the midwife's point of view, but also as a woman who was successful only after 14 months having a cesarean, pushing my baby out of my vagina.
I guess having the information helped you make an informed decision about which way you were going to go in your
Absolutely.
Pregnancy.
And
Absolutely. That's, I guess, the sort of thing that you're trying to get out there with the research that you're undertaking, is helping women to perhaps make informed decisions about their pregnancies.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely. That's what I've done. So I looked at women who planned a VBAC at home, first of all, because I thought that's potentially, like, it's one of the most disagreed on choices. You know, women, if you're having a VBAC, you shouldn't have that at home. And that's what the research and the policies and the guidelines will say. But it's also one of the areas where women have a higher chance of achieving a VBAC. You know, any out-of-hospital VBAC or any out-of-hospital choice gives you higher VBAC rates. So that's why I really wanted to explore those experiences, which I did. And it was really interesting, you know, almost from it, it was, well, why it was actually going to be harder for these women to birth in the hospital. And often the women didn't make the decision straight away. It wasn't that, right, I want to have a VBAC at home, that's what I'm going to do. It was often because they were bullied into it. So they would go back to the hospitals second time round. And women who've had a cesarean and then planned a VBAC are in a very unique position, because often it's because they've had the cascade of intervention that ended in cesarean. So then, logically, you don't want that cascade again. And so often the women in that study, they would go to the hospital and they'd say, you know, I don't want the CTG and I don't want to be induced. I don't want this because that all led to cesarean last time. But often there was no negotiation from the hospital's point of view. It was, well, you do it our way or you go away. And surprisingly, women didn't just, not all women just said, okay, we'll do what you say. They would actually go and find something else. They'd get onto the internet. They'd do some Googling and find out, actually, there's a whole community out there that do this at home. And then women would find, the majority of women found a private midwife, and the attitude from the private midwife was very different. It wasn't a no, it was a, okay, sure, I'll support you and I'll help you through this and I'll provide midwifery care for you. And so the difference in reaction and the difference in support was so tangible, like it was so obvious. And even when women had in that study, if they had to transfer in to a hospital, I think from the healthcare provider's point of view, they would see that as a failed VBAC, even if they'd already pushed the baby out the vagina and it was after the birth that they had to transfer in for a bleed or for a tear or something they needed to go in for. I think from the healthcare professionals in the hospital, they were like, oh my gosh, you know, why did you bother doing that at home? It was so risky and now you've had to come in anyway. But for the women, that was just like a mere blip on the actual whole experience. It's like, yeah, but I did all this stuff at home. I labored at home. I have a baby at home. Yeah. And then I just had to go in for a short period and then I came back out again. And so it was a very different attitude from the women. And that's what makes me very excited about doing research from women's points of views, because we get a very different idea about what is important and what is the most important thing. And it does challenge healthcare providers who then have their own ideas on what is most important.
Yeah. I think it's about really asking the women. And I think that's what you've done when you looked at the home birth, why women choose to home birth after a cesarean. And I suppose that's led you into your more recent paper about the narrative. Oh, I'm sorry if I got this wrong.
Yeah, you might. So what happened, as soon as I'd finished my master's, I knew I wanted to do my PhD. Because I just had the research bug, absolutely. And I did that research a little bit differently than is usually done. I wanted to find out how women felt after each appointment. So I didn't want to video the appointment because I'm not getting into women's heads at that point. I'm just seeing two actors at play. I wanted to learn, you know, when you go and see your doctor and you've got a whole big script in your head, and then you go into the doctor and you're like the stunned rabbit, you can't remember anything that you've just said. You come home and then you're like, oh crap, why didn't I say this? Or why did they say that? Or the appointment went really well or it didn't. That's the moment I wanted. I wanted those aha moments. So I got an extra scholarship to be able to pay and design an app so that when women went home, they could open the app on their phone and they could press record and they would do either video or an audio recording on how they felt after that appointment. So I ended up with these really amazing in-depth stories from women throughout their pregnancy and then afterwards. And that's when I then did a narrative analysis. So instead of breaking it all apart, I kept their stories intact and then I compared and contrasted across the stories to see similar themes and what came up as important.
And for you, what were some of those common denominators that you were seeing across the board there with tracking that through the MyVBAC app?
It was so much information. Like I had so much data. It was a challenging time. I ended up being in my family were in the UK and I had to go back to the UK because my grandma passed away and I had to help my mum with all the stuff that was going on. Found myself in the library in my old hometown after trudging through the snow. And that's when I had my light bulb moment. I'm looking at this information. I'm going, well, what is it that's going on? And I realized that there were these four important factors and they were having control, having confidence, having a relationship, and staying active in labor. And each of those four factors were common amongst all the women, but how they felt or how I would potentially score them on each of those factors was different depending to, you know, some may have felt really high, really, really in control, and others felt less in control. And then depending on if they were high or low on those factors, that then impacted how they felt after their birthing experience. So, and that's regardless of the type of birth they ended up having. So they may feel really disappointed if they're scoring low, or really satisfied and happy if they scored if they were higher on those levels. So it's almost like a scalable factor. And one of those examples that really came out was when I did two interviews in one day, and on paper, they both looked the same. Both women had got to fully dilated, and both women had a repeat cesarean at that point. And on paper, you'd be like, okay, fair enough. But I interviewed both those women, and both those women were in very different places emotionally. I could easily say one was much more satisfied and one was devastated on her experiences. And that's what made me think there's something there, like what is going on? How do we unpick that? So for the woman that felt really devastated, she didn't have, actually she had continuity of care, but that person never knew who she was from one, it was just happened to be seeing the same doctor, but that doctor never really built up a relationship with her. So she scored very low in the relationship. She had very little control because the decisions were made for her. And she was always, you know, even during pregnancy, she's told, well, you know, oh, you want to have a VBAC, do you? Oh, well, we'll see if the stars are aligned for you on that day. And then when she did go into hospital, she actually went into hospital pretty much fully dilated and then had the control taken off her again. She was told, well, if you don't have this baby, like in 10 minutes, we're going to go to theatres. She didn't have the control to be able to wait for her partner to get back because she didn't even realise she was that far along. So he was taking his time doing stuff. Like she had no control in that scenario. Whereas the other woman who felt really satisfied, she made the decision. Like she had continuity of care with a midwife. She made a lot of decisions during her pregnancy and that she could take ownership for, did everything during her labour that she particularly could. She was as active as she could be. And then when she'd been fully dilated for a couple of hours, she then made the call and said, that's it, I've had enough, I'd like to go for a repeat cesarean now. And those two experiences, which if you just looked on paper would be so similar, were so different in what the women took away from it. So that's where I came up with those four factors. And I think they really ring true. So, you know, how controlled do you feel as a woman planning this feedback? Now, you can't control everything. I know we've got this whole unknown part of labour and birth, but how controlled do you feel about your wishes, your birth choices, the people that you have with you? And this is right now with COVID-19, yes. Some of that control is being taken away because you're being told who you can have in the birth room and who you can't, because they're reducing those numbers, which is going to be a bit of a challenge as well.
So on that, I was just going to quickly ask you if you do have any advice to any women out there listening during this time and any resources they're able to use.
I really hope that women who are in continuity of care models with midwives, they stay in those models. I think they're going to show how perfect those models are during this time, because you've got the same person that you can go back to and ask the questions from, and you're not going to get different opinions each time you go in. Plus, those midwives have got the flexibility to maybe see you outside of hospitals and maybe in outreach clinics. So it's, yeah, what can you do to keep that going? There's a lot of women looking for home birth midwives right now, which will soon become saturated because there's a limited amount, in the hope to at least have the control, because at least they can control who's going to be in the home.
Yes.
But if they can't control who's going to be in the hospital, I think really it's not going to be till we look back at this time that we realise what the challenges really were and what the experiences were. I think it's keeping that communication going. Hopefully, if you're in a continuity of care model, that is going on for you. But what I do fear is that health services don't respect continuity of care models enough, and that they close them down to get those midwives back onto core staff. That would be devastating.
Mm.
That really will be devastating. But I have a feeling, knowing the health services I do, that that could potentially be happening. So I really hope the midwives in those areas in continuity care are fighting and saying, no, we need to stay. It's really important because they're making such a difference. But for women themselves, oh, that's a bit of a hard one.
I don't know, but I'm quite curious to know, what are our human rights in childbirth? You know, it is a human rights issue. I think personally, I feel, you know, if I can't have my husband or someone I really trust in the birth space, I'd be devastated. I really would be. And I'd feel like...
Well, the challenge is these things are changing so quickly. So I think we've got what is the normal situation for being, for control?
Yeah.
And then what is going on right now when we've got a public health disaster that is affecting the whole world. And I think it's kind of sensible to separate the two. But then right, if you're a pregnant woman right now, this is affecting you right now.
Of course, yes.
And so I think you just need to keep having that communication with the healthcare providers, but also being aware that, you know, you shouldn't be birthing alone. And they can't just say to you that a midwife is going to provide that care for you, because that midwife is going to be looking after other women as well, if she's not your midwifery group practice midwife, for example. So it's a challenge. Mm-hmm. It really is a challenge. But I think if you only allowed one or two people with you in labour, I would be picking those people really carefully. Is it someone that's going to be very supportive to you? Obviously, in most scenarios, you will want the partner, your partner, your significant partner with you. But then who else? You know, is it going to be somebody that is there to advocate and support you? And have you had conversations with them about how they're going to do that? You know, have they learned the same things that you have about active labour and about acupressure points and all the things that are important for you to do? Have you told those to the people that you're now choosing to be with you, and not to pick people just because they want to be there? It's going to be, how can they serve you? If they're going to be in that room, they need to be useful to you. So I think that's probably the only thing. If I was having to look at how I would limit the people being with me, I'd be choosing the people that are going to be the most useful to me. And that might even be a doula. So if you have to make the choice about a doula or your mother, is your mother going to be just as beneficial to you, or are they just saying that they need to be there compared to a doula who's trained to help you in labour? But if I look back at the other times, which would be the normal times, then I think, you know, the control thing is, you know, what is most important to you? Who is going to be the most useful people for you? And you've got to train them up so that they're aware of the things you want to do. Well, the other factors, though, are equally as important. There wasn't one factor that was just as more important than the others. So the other one is confidence, which is really challenging for women planning a VBAC if you've never had a vaginal birth before. We do know that if you've had a vaginal birth before and then a cesarean and then you want to plan a VBAC, you've got a much higher chance of having a VBAC. Well, that's because it's not the uterus, it's not the vagina, it's the brain that you're convincing there. Your brain already knows that you've pushed a baby out through your vagina, and then it didn't next time round, but you can do it because it's already been tried and tested. You know that your body can do that. So the confidence is what's going on in your brain, and that is very challenging if you've never had a vaginal birth before. For myself, I dropped the ball when I was in transition. Luckily, I had a friend come and support me at the last minute. She turned up in transition, and I just had verbal diarrhea at that point. What if I can't do this? What if I can't do that? What if blah, blah, blah? And she was just able to listen to that and then go, oh, you know, if I can have a vaginal birth, Hazel, you're the strongest woman I've ever met. I'm sure you can. I'm like, yeah, you're right. Which probably wasn't the nicest thing to say at that point. But in my head, it was like, yeah, absolutely, I can do this. So, you know, how do you get that confidence, though? Well, I think you get that confidence by learning again about normal birth. You know, there are so many things out there, and women do access these things like active birth classes or calm birth, or, you know, there's lots of different names out there, but alternate birth classes that are done in the community. A lot of those right now are being done online, and you can still access those courses online rather than face-to-face. Learn about your body and learn about how you can best support your body and how the people around you can best support you to stay active and to have as much normality around labour and birth that you can when you're planning a VBAC, and what's going to be best for you. But the other thing in confidence, which was really interesting that came out, was women were acutely aware of how confident their healthcare provider was in the woman's ability to have a VBAC. So if you've got a healthcare provider who doesn't seem very confident, and every time you talk about wanting to have a VBAC, they might say, oh, well, this might happen, or that might happen, or I'm not sure if that's going to happen, or let's just see what your blood pressure does on the day. And like, if they're not instilling you with confidence, then are you really going to the right person? And if you have chosen that person, then why have you chosen that person? Is it the right person to go to? Your healthcare provider should be saying, I am fully confident in your ability to have a VBAC. Sometimes it doesn't happen, but I am going to be there and I am going to support you, and I am 100% confident that you are able to achieve this, and I'm there for you to help you with that. If your healthcare provider isn't saying that, then why not? And can you find somebody else that will be supporting you? because little, you know, if you're seeing that healthcare provider throughout your pregnancy, you're getting little drip feedings that can be diminishing your own confidence. If every time you see them, they just knock your confidence a bit more, and you've already got a knocked confidence because you haven't had a vaginal birth yet, imagine the state you're going to be in by the time you go into labor. Do you really feel that you can do that? Are you going to feel that you can do it? And then if the people in the room don't feel that you can do it, what is the likelihood that you're going to be able to push through one of the hardest experiences you'll ever have in your life if you don't feel confident and the people around you are not confident?
For women listening out there who are experiencing what you describe at their antenatal appointments and having that lip service of, well, you can try your VBAC and see if the stars align, what advice do you have to give to them? I know some women out there will be feeling, well, I can't really change hospitals at the last minute, can I? You know, they'll be feeling a great sense of anxiety about that, particularly at the moment. What is possible for that, for those women, and what are the viable options, I suppose?
Well, if you feel that the people that you're seeing are not confident in it, and that is much more likely in, and I've got a paper that is the last phase, which was the national survey that is being reviewed at the moment, that shows you how likely it is to, and across the different models of care, which is standard antenatal care, which is fragmented, where you see somebody different each time. Contingent of care with a doctor, which is most likely with a private obstetrician, and contingent of care with a midwife, which is maybe MGP or a private midwife. You are less likely to feel that your healthcare providers are confident in you if you are in standard fragmented care, which is unfortunate because that's the most common type of care. The second level is if you're with a private obstetrician, and then the highest level of confidence is if you're with a midwifery group practice or with continued care with a midwife. So if you cannot change that last minute, well, you know, if you can't change what is around you, then change who else is with you. So who's going in there with you? Is it a doula that you need to find who will instill that confidence for you and to help you with that confidence? But it's a challenging situation, and really it's something that you are quite surprised by, because there's this whole switch and bait thing that happens. You might go and see a healthcare provider, say that's a private obstetrician, for example, who is very keen at the beginning and is like, oh yes, absolutely, I have great VBACs and I'm really supportive of you having a VBAC. And then as the pregnancy goes on and you're getting closer to having your baby, now there starts to be issues. Oh well, you know, only if this happens, and you're going to have this happen to you, and you're going to have to go for this ultrasound, and I'm not going to let you go past 40 weeks and all this stuff. It's like that real switch and bait, you know, like they baited you in and now they're switching their decision at the end. And you're like, well, what can you do now? And that is a very challenging situation to then leave that provider or leave that hospital last minute, especially in this current climate, would be very, very difficult. In that situation, you're going to have to look at how you can be confident. Can you look at your peer support? So go onto your Facebook pages that have the VBAC support groups and look for support from them. Look for support from, you know, maybe having a doula or someone around you that can support you, that's external to the hospital but is still really knowledgeable about normal birth and VBAC. One of the questions I've got to ask is, why do they do that? Like, why are they so fearful about VBAC? And that's certainly where my postdoc work is going to be looking at, is, you know, well, how can we actually increase confidence in healthcare providers? I do it when I go to conferences. I challenge midwives to take ownership of VBAC and to get confident in it. And I suggest some ways that they can. Women out there are getting such shocking comments and such disgraceful behavior from healthcare providers, that how can you feel confident with them? It's a big, big challenge for women.
And there are very few mechanisms to hold anyone accountable for that kind of treatment, I suppose. I mean, no one feels like they're in a position to really hold anyone accountable for that, I suppose.
Women's been
through that. Yeah.
Women can vote with their feet, right? Like if you're seeing it that you're paying for, then you know you wouldn't why are you paying for someone who can just hurl abuse at you? Like that, this doesn't make any sense. Like just because you've got private healthcare cover and you want to have your own single room and have TV in your room, but you'll put up with someone hurling abuse at you. And that might be passive aggressive abuse as well. So you're not quite so aware of it. Like make your choices. Women are making their choices. Women are choosing midwifery group practices, which is why it's so hard to get into so many, because women are choosing MGPs and we need to step up in the health service to provide more continuity of care with a midwife, because we know that works. And with the work that I've done and the research I've done, we know it works. And it's so important for women who are planning a VBAC. But then, you know, if they have had a shocking time, and this is for women who've had a cesarean, their primary cesarean, like there are avenues to complain, but we are taught not to complain. And that's, I guess that's the feminist researcher in me too. Like, and we're asking people to complain during a time that is really difficult. You know, those first few months after you've had a baby and you're dealing with maybe, you know, major abdominal surgery from a cesarean, and maybe you've got some real head stuff going on because of that, and you've got sleepless nights, and you're looking after a baby, and you've got, like, to then say, and right now, make sure that you send a letter of complaint into the hospital at the same time. Like, seriously, you'd never remember how to, like, you've then got to find who do you send that information to. Like, you don't have time for that. This is the time that is, it's not the time for complaining, is it? And then if you wait too long, then they're like, oh, yeah, but, you know, what are we going to do at this
point? And there's also that rhetoric of people saying to you, you should just be happy to leave the hospital with a healthy baby and you're healthy. What is your response to that kind of...
I get so infuriated by that response, you know, well, at least you've got a well baby. And yes, that's true. That is fantastic that you do have a well baby. And there may well have been situations where an emergency cesarean had to occur for that baby. It's actually quite rare that actually happens, but occasionally it does. But even then, that doesn't mean that the woman gets treated like a slab of meat and is disrespected through the whole experience. What is the point of having a nice live baby if you've got a woman who can't function and can no longer feel confident in her ability to be able to be a mother? And yeah, ends up with more rates of post-traumatic stress disorder after birth or postnatal depression. Like, we really need to be, we know how important it is for women's mental health to be good mothers. So how can we say just having a healthy baby is the benchmark? That's a very low benchmark. You know, that's the standard, right? That's what we're sending women home who are confident to be good mothers, who are in good emotional places, who actually feel the triumphant experience of having a birth that was empowering and has formed and created them to go into motherhood in a better way, rather than just saying, well, you've got a live baby, so you'll survive. They won't survive. They don't. And we know that the biggest killer of women in the first year after having a baby is suicide. So we're not having great women out there if we give them really traumatic experiences. And that is, like, one of the big things about birth trauma is women would say they had a lack of control and they felt a loss of control. So then we need to take ownership as healthcare professionals as well. And how do we build that control then? How can that be a woman's decision in the end to go to have a repeat cesarean, rather than it be us saying you have to do this? And how, if we use threatening language, we're taking control away.
On the hospital forms, women are told failure to progress. It kind of can affect you in that early mothering, you know, what you were talking about. The words failure on your birth record, it's just not very nice.
It's terrible, because if you failed, you already feel like you haven't done something quite right. You know, when you've had a cesarean, you spend a lot of those waking moments going, you know, what could I have done differently? And so to have that reinforced, and that's what our language is doing, it's reinforcing what a woman might also already be feeling, will just compound it. And so our language is terrible. You know, you failure to progress, a failed induction. Like, there's so many fails, and really it's not a failure of the woman, but that's what we take on board. The failure to progress is probably a failure to wait from the healthcare, from the systems point of view. and a failed induction is the fact that we're doing an induction when the body wasn't completely right or the baby wasn't in the best position, and it was a failure of the medications. It wasn't really a failure of the woman and everything that's involved in being in labour and having a baby. But we can say that. We can say, oh, it's not a failure, but it's what the woman takes away. And then that just compounds the feelings that she's already having. It would be fantastic to change that language, because yes, if it's written down, then it means that's what's being in the spoken word as well. And when, you know, the doctor comes round after you've had the cesarean and just justifies the reason that you had your cesarean and then says, but, you know, at least you've got a healthy baby at the end of it, and that's not debriefing, and that's just justifying the position and why you did surgery. And that area is something that I'll be moving into in postdoc work as well, because that's something that I have a bit of a bugbear about. So after I did the narrative analysis, just so I can bring some of the other research in to help support what I'm saying, is, yeah, the having a relationship was about continuity of care. The more, the better relationship you've got, but not just continuity of care. All continuity of care is different. It's got to be a relationship that is built on respect and trust and belief, not just seeing the same person all the time and maybe seeing them for 5 minutes. And then staying active in labour. This is kind of where the crescendo of all those other three factors, and this is where it comes into play. Women really need to feel that they were active in labour and had the opportunity to do everything they could to achieve the birth that they want. I then used those four factors to design a national survey, which was the last part of my PhD. And I put that out a year ago. I was just looking at that, writing up in my methodology chapter. It was a year ago that was out. And I looked for women who were either currently pregnant and then another group of women who had previously planned to be back in the last 5 years. That's the group I've looked at. I have to be honest, I've not even looked at the ones that were currently pregnant yet. But I looked at the big data for the women that were planned to be back in the last 5 years. I had 490 women across Australia in every state and territory. And it was a really successful survey, actually. And then I looked at the data, but I looked at it through a different lens. I looked at it by comparing the type of model of care they had. So did they have fragmented care? Did they have continuity of care with a doctor? Or did they have continuity of care with a midwife? And then I compared all their experiences. And that's what I've put together in a paper that's currently being reviewed. So hopefully that will be out this year. So it's been reviewed for the last month or so. And
looking forward to it.
I'm quite excited by it. So, you know, it does look at all the different women's experiences, but I do look at it in compared to those four factors.
Yes.
Of control, confidence, active labour, and relationships. So that's where I've really grouped the questions, and then I've compared it against the models of care that you go, that women are in. One group I'm particularly interested in looking at was women that have special scars. So now I've got the trajectory of women that had an alternate or special scar, and how their, you know, what happened on their journey. So that's something I really, there's not as many women, but I have all their comments as well. There's a lot more stuff I can do with the data that's there, and there will be more stuff that comes out because I asked so much. I did ask women if they received hurtful comments. Unfortunately, over half of women did receive hurtful comments, and then I had the opportunity of giving women the opportunity to write down what those hurtful comments were, and I've collected all of those, and I share some of those when I go to conferences now, just to kind of, you know, say to healthcare professionals, this is what women are being told. And this is only in the last few years. And they're horrible comments. They're just disgraceful. Like, they're one that, you know, there's the dead baby card is used a lot. But there's so much more to unpack around that. So one of the comments, I probably won't get it verbatim, was a woman was told that if you die, if you plan for VBAC, your husband will end up with a dead wife and a dead baby and a toddler to raise on his own. There's nothing about the woman and how she felt in that. It was completely, as a feminist researcher, that drives me insane, because it just completely takes the woman out of it. And it's like, oh, well, you know, what about your poor husband? What's he going to end up with? And yes, it's very true. If in the extremely rare case that a woman would die from uterine rupture, and that is so rare, if she did, I am absolutely sure that her partner would have a very tough time and would get a lot of grief and have a lot of loss. But it's such a rare thing to be able to use that in that patriarchal manner of saying, you don't really matter, but your husband does matter more, because his life would be so much harder. if you go for this feedback because you're likely to die. And it's just so untrue and it's so manipulative. And it's just disgraceful. It's really quite illuminating. But what I did find is 2/3 of women who did that survey said that their previous cesarean was traumatic. That's huge. That's much more than the birth trauma data that we normally have, which is usually about 1/3 of women.
When you talk about the trauma and how, you know, it's hard for women to verbalize or write it down, especially in that postpartum period, to go back to give feedback, what are some suggestions you can give to these women to support them? What are the ways in which women can work through that?
I think there are different ways, and I think it depends on how severe it is for you. But the first thing is to recognize that you might need to speak to somebody. You know, that help can be varied. And if you go to someone, say, like your GP, and you have actually got real symptoms of PTSD, for example, and they dismiss you, then go and get further help and to try and find someone who might have some experience with that. I think you need to be careful what you find online. There are at least one website that I am extremely aware of that does use the terms birth and trauma together, but it's not anything to do with looking after your mental health. It was set up to, I guess, discredit the normal birth movement, if I could say that, and it's more about how awful it is for people to have perineal trauma. So just be wary what you're looking at. Always look at, you know, where does this information come from? If they start talking about things like the physical trauma, that's very different from psychological trauma. So I would be careful about that. Obviously, I'm not going to say any names or anything, but just be aware of what's out there. But I think if you spoke to a midwife, or if you spoke to your child and family health nurse or maternal health nurse, then they would also be able to give you access to counselling that might be available. So I think you really need to get that help. But it is still relatively new, and so maybe not all healthcare providers are up on it. So if they knock you back, but you're still getting, you know, you're getting flashbacks, or you're in a really bad way, or you know, you're having nightmares, and I mean, it's hard to say that you're having lack of sleep because you've got a newborn baby that you're looking at as well. But if you've got really concerned images coming up in your head, and there's a whole list of things, then you just go and get help, first of all. And if that help isn't helpful, go and find other help. Reach out to the peers, like, you know, talk about it. You know, go to the good organisations, make sure the reputable organisations, Beyond Blue, and, you know, good organisations that look at mental health.
Hazel, I have a question about the rhetoric we hear about being a good candidate for VBAC. Are there any scenarios where one would not be a good candidate for VBAC? Is there such a thing?
Well, look, there's a few things that you can look at there. I mean, you know, what is a good candidate in the first place? Like, there's an element to risk to absolutely everything that you do. Right now, there's an element of risk if you leave the house.
Yes.
And you go to the shop and you've got to stand on a little X to make sure that you're, you know, 1.5 meters from somebody. But are we still going to go out and buy our milk and eggs and everything that we need? Of course we are. We are going to take on that risk to go and do that. So it really depends on the individual circumstances. There might be some circumstances that are would maybe make you think, you know, is this something I might be doing? That might be if you've had a full-on vertical scar, right, top to bottom, you know, the uterus doesn't heal as well, and there are higher rupture rates with that. But still, that's not a 99% rupture rate, and that data that we have is very old because it's not done very much these days. But with even with special scars that have been extended a little bit either way, or maybe are just a slightly different shape, that doesn't mean that you can't have a VBAC either, but our policies will say that you can't. But your rupture rate may increase just that little bit more. So what is a good candidate for having a VBAC? Well, first of all, you must have had a cesarean before, otherwise you're not even having a vaginal birth after cesarean. And the next thing is if you've got a vagina, then really that's kind of all you need, and you're pregnant and you want to push a baby out. That's kind of it. There may be other things that mean that your risks are just slightly higher, and that's then for you to decide and have a conversation with your healthcare provider on, well, what's the best way to make sure that I'm being monitored or I'm aware that anything is happening. Certainly, you know, having an epidural during your VBAC, I don't think is a great idea, because you want to really be aware of what kind of sensations you're having. But, you know, if you're twins, should you be able to have a VBAC? Yes, you should be able to have a VBAC. If you've got a breech, yes, you should still be able to have a VBAC. And can you have an external cephalic version, you know, the turn? Yes, you can still do that if you're a VBAC. There's very little out there that from the research that I would confidently say, no, you can't have a VBAC. And then who would be the ones to say that you can't? Anyway, this should be a choice that you come to, that you are confident and comfortable with, and your healthcare provider and your support team are comfortable with. And that's a decision for a woman, because it's her body. And it's her body that is growing this baby, that is birthing this baby, and that will be feeding the baby and will be caring for the baby. So I think that's, I find it very difficult to say that you shouldn't or you shouldn't. Oh, what about if you've had more than one cesarean? Well, you know, I've done a video on that on my VBAC researcher page. You know, actually, after two, and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists are now supporting after two, there's very little difference in ruptures. But why can't you have one after three or after four? It just makes your rupture rate slightly higher. But if you are confident and your healthcare team are then supporting you to do that. The crazy thing is, when the healthcare team doesn't support you to do it, women then go, well, I'm going to do that at home. And the healthcare team don't seem to have an issue with that. Yeah. Like the woman in my study who had in the qualitative phase, who had an inverted T scar, and she stayed at home and labored at home and then turned up fully dilated. So that she, because she felt safer because she'd had so much negative feedback from the hospital. When that just seems absolutely ludicrous. If the hospital is saying it's more dangerous to do this, then why are you pushing women out to the community to do that?
Yeah, because surely that's there's greater danger associated, I suppose, with not having any contact there at all with anyone.
That's right.
And it's a bit of an indictment on the system, where we have women who don't feel safe, who feel safer in their own lounge room than they do in hospital settings.
Yeah, and that's no reflection on the woman. That's a reflection on the health system. And there's a great book that's just come out,
yes,
The Canary in the Coal Mine, which I wrote a chapter in, which is a whole book about, you know, the half of the book is about the issue and half of the book is about how to fix it, looking at that particular issue. What is it? What are we doing when we are not negotiating with women and we're pushing women away, and then the birthing in the community? And what does this really say? Or what it really says is that the health system is broken. And I think if we want to have a litmus test on the broken health system, it's VBAC. You know, people are so scared about VBAC. And 86% of women who have had a previous cesarean and are pregnant will go on to have a repeat cesarean. We have such low VBAC rates in this country that then our healthcare providers, almost like the breech thing, are becoming de-skilled and underconfident in supporting women who are planning a VBAC. And then that's where this fear comes out and where the hurtful comments really come out. We've got whole hospitals that won't support women to have a VBAC. They're just closed for VBAC. Sorry, you can't have a VBAC at this hospital. But you know what? You could go down the road and you could go to that really, really big, busy hospital to have a VBAC if you want. But we do elective cesareans at this hospital. And so you could just come in and you know when that's going to be, and you've got your own room and we'll care for you and you'll be in your own community. Like, it's the language around that. If the woman's been going home going, well, I have to go to that hospital and they don't make it sound very nice, or I could just stay in my local one where I know everyone and my family, it's easy for them to visit. Like, what are we doing when we are closing or not making VBAC an option? We are turning women to have an elective cesarean just in our language and what we're offering them.
Hazel, are there countries or regions out there that have a better rate than Australia in terms of, you know, you say 86% of women who have had a cesarean will have a repeat cesarean. Is there a country out there that we should maybe model of, or
Yes, there are. So there's a whole group of countries, and they are more often the Scandinavian countries. So over in Europe, there was a fantastic research group that got together called Optibirth, and they looked at the – they did lots of different things, but they did look at the countries with high VBAC rates, and they compared them to the countries in Europe with low VBAC rates. May I just add, though, those low VBAC rates were 22% and we were only on 14%. So even then, those low VBAC rates are doing better than we were.
A higher.
Yeah. We match the US. So there's some something to make you think about, really, isn't it? When our VBAC rate matches the US. And I did a little video on this on the VBAC Researcher page about the high and the low. They did look at what's going on in those countries. And in the countries with high VBAC rates, they talk about this, the same belief across what the women, the midwives and the obstetricians believe. And what they all believe was that VBAC is the best option. VBAC is the first option that you should go to. So the woman wants to have a VBAC, the midwife is supporting VBAC, and the obstetricians are supporting VBAC. So there's this hegemony, there's this beautiful equality and equal decisions from everyone. Now, if they've got women that have had a fear of childbirth, or are requesting a cesarean, doesn't mean they don't get a cesarean, but they will maybe go to a birth fear clinic where they are seen by the same midwife, and they'll also have input from psychologists as well to actually unpack what is it that they're scared of, why don't they want to have a VBAC, what are those issues, and how can we help support you during those issues. And it's a, and so they're all, you know, VBAC is the first choice, and that's the choice that everyone's going to go to, so there's not really an issue there. Then in the low VBAC rate countries, which were still higher than ours, remember, those low VBAC rate countries, there was a discrepancy in beliefs. So the woman might want to have a VBAC, the midwife might be supporting VBAC, but then maybe the obstetric team are against VBAC. And then there's this discrepancy and there's this fight. So then the obstetric or the maternity team say, well, it's the woman's choice what she wants to do. So when you read that as a feminist, you're like, absolutely, it's absolutely the woman's choice. But this is where the problems come in, is that the woman then has to fight a system because her choice isn't really what they're thinking that she should be doing. And it's against what the norm of women are doing. So then the woman is having to have this fight. And that, I believe, is one of the foundations to it causing a lower VBAC rate. And I really think that's something that we can take on board to look at our country is, and we've got the data there from the survey, is that women do have a fight. And when they have that fight, well, what are your options in that fight? Your option might be you're going to stick to that fight and you're going to leave the hospital, though, and you're going to go and birth in peace. And that's, I think, the title of the chapter I put in that book, Fight the Fight or Birth in Peace. So they choose, you know what, I'm going to leave that fight to the hospital. They can just continue. I'm going to go and find someone who supports me and does that out of hospital. But remember, that is still a very, very small amount of women that do that. Then you've got the women in the hospital system. Do they continue the fight? Are they able to get into a program that really supports them more? So if they're in a midwifery group practice, then maybe there's less of a fight. There's still a little bit of a fight, though. They still receive hurtful comments because they might then go and see, they might have a policy that they have to see a doctor during their antenatal period, and then that might be where they get a different opinion. Or it might be that the midwives themselves are feeling fearful about new policies coming in or stress is put on them, and then they may, you know, unfortunately also put some pressure on the woman. So you might fight, you might choose to continue with that fight of VBAC in the hospital system, or you might choose the elective cesarean, and then all of a sudden you find there's absolutely no fight whatsoever. They're saying, right, let's book you in, and this is the day that you're going to be able to have your cesarean. And all of a sudden there's no communication about the risks of having a repeat cesarean. There's loads of conversation about the risks of having a VBAC, but not the same risks are given to you, which are actually higher, for having a repeat cesarean. Suddenly it's like you have joined the sheep, joined the mass following, and therefore you're not going to have a fight on your hand anymore. And I think that's what we can take from these high and low VBAC countries. What we then need to do from that is, well, how can we get everyone to believe that VBAC is the best option? Like, how can we go to that? They tried that with Optibirth. They tried that with bringing in some interventions, and they didn't see any difference in those low VBAC rate countries when they brought those in. It really shows you it's a very deep systemic issue. And I think these issues first of all need to come from women, and women need to kind of, you know, really be fighting for it a bit more. It's a very challenging situation, yeah.
Just based on that, Hazel, what you said about the risks of VBAC and repeat cesarean, could you share with us a little bit about that? Because not often, you're right, like I know from my own experience, the risks of cesarean wasn't really touched on very much, because I guess both have long-term implications. Could you share with us what those risks, I guess, entail?
Sure. So with a VBAC, obviously the risk that there is spoken a lot about is uterine rupture. Yeah. And it's depending on the statistics out there or the studies, but it does show that it's generally less than 1%. So maybe of chances of doing that. It's increased a bit more if we give you medications such as Prostin or Syntocinon, so the medication that you might get during induction or augmentation. So that does increase the uterine rupture a little bit more, but still really no more than 2% in most of those cases as well. So that's still very, very low. You may also have the risk of, if you're planning a VBAC, that the VBAC might not happen and you might have a repeat cesarean. So then you've got the risks involved in having a repeat cesarean. Now, when you, just to unpack what the studies look like with this, because often the studies will be done and they'll come out and they'll say, you know, the women that planned a VBAC, they had higher chances of X, Y, and Z compared to those that had that planned an elective cesarean. And they have these two different groups, those that chose elective cesarean from the outset and those that chose VBAC from the outset. But they're essentially flawed, because what they should be is three groups. There should be those that had the elective cesarean, those that planned a VBAC and got a VBAC, and then those that planned a VBAC and had a repeat emergency cesarean. That's three different groups. I don't have three hands. That's three different groups, not two different groups. So if you look at it in two different groups, the ones who have less mortality and morbidity on both neonatal and mother are going to be those that had elective cesarean, because the ones in the planned VBAC group also have the repeat emergency cesarean group in it. So if we separate out into three, so if we have those that are having a VBAC, women who have plan a VBAC and have a VBAC do best out of all of the groups when it comes to maternal morbidity and mortality and neonatal outcomes. They're the healthiest, and they have less bleeding, they have less infections, and they have a better breastfeeding rates, and less neonates going into, less babies going into special care nursery, better all-round outcome. The next step down would then be those who plan an elective cesarean. Now, an elective cesarean, as you understand, is very set. You know when it's going to be. You're not in labour to begin with in the majority of examples, but you still end up with a higher, compared to VBAC or achieving VBAC, you still end up with slightly higher infection rates just because you're having major abdominal surgery, more bleeding because you get more bleeding with cesareans, and there may be some decreased breastfeeding rates, and because you're having a cesarean, the baby may have more rates of respiratory issues because, you know, they're not getting that squeeze as they come out through the vagina. Then the case that does worst, I guess, if we're looking at maternal morbidity and mortality, and in this country, to be fair, there's still small amounts because we do have very high standards of healthcare and very good standards of hygiene in theatres, would be the emergency ones, because things are a little bit more emergency. But there are very few, even with emergency, we have different categories. The category one, the cat one, as we talk about, we have very few of those really in labour. You know, you might suddenly go, oh, it's an emergency, we need you to sign, and then, like, you're not even in theatres for another hour. You know, how urgent was that? So if it's in that emergency scenario, then there can be higher rates of operative injuries, such as if they've got to get the baby out quickly, they're not able to do the operation quite as slowly and as measured as they would like. There might be some slightly higher chances of having damage to the bladder. There are slightly higher infection rates, bleeding rates, all that kind of stuff. But it's important to, when you look at the studies that come out there, to think, how have they presented their data? Is it just electives, those that planned elective and those that planned VBAC, or is it in the three different groups? So when you are planning a VBAC, obviously you have, depending on where you plan your VBAC, you have about a 60 to 80% chance of having a VBAC. And then there's that group that might have an emergency cesarean. And that's where some healthcare providers will push it and say, well, if you have an elective, you know you're having an elective. If you're planning a VBAC, you don't know, you might end up with a emergency cesarean, and that's where it could be riskier.
If you have more children, if you have a repeat cesarean, when I did my own research, I read about placenta accreta. I'm not sure
accreta, if you yes. So if you have more cesareans, then you have got more likelihood of having abnormal placental adherence. So the placenta might, because you've got, you know, you've got this scar, and you've got, you might potentially have scar tissue in there as well. So there just seem to be more rates of abnormal placental positions, and also the way that it connects onto the uterus, so the accretias. So yes, that can happen with the more cesareans that you have. You can put a, you know, if you have a VBAC, you put a stop to that. Because, you know, if you have a cesarean and then another cesarean and then another cesarean and then another cesarean, you are each time you are increasing your chances of having any of the morbidity and mortality issues, such as, you know, your bleeding will increase with the more cesareans. You've got your rates of infection, wound dehiscence. So that means the actual wound on your cesarean actually it coming apart. That obviously then gives you a risk of wound infection, as well as infection inside the uterus as well. And they increase the more cesareans that you have. If you have a cesarean and then a VBAC, you're stopping it. Like you're stopping it there. And then that's not, you know, that's not continuing. We're not seeing that with repeat VBACs.
And after you've had a VBAC, the risk of uterine rupture, does it actually go down?
It doesn't change in that way. It would still be, you know, less than 1% in the majority of cases. But your chance of having a VBAC increases.
Yes. Okay.
So then, you know, that's the thing that really changes. And that's what I was saying before. It's not to do with the vagina or the uterus. It's to do with the brain. And that's the confidence. The woman knows that she can do this. So the actual likelihood of her then going on and having another VBAC is so much higher, because you believe your body has already done this, you've experienced it, and you can do it again. Women that had home births in the HBAC study, they often had a VBAC first of all. Some of them had a VBAC first of all in the hospital. And then they were like, well, I've got the confidence. I know that I can have a VBAC now. But the way that I was treated, or the way that it went, isn't exactly how I would want a birth to go. So now I'm choosing to do that at home. And their VBAC rates are higher. The VBAC rates are also higher for out-of-hospital VBACs. But I will put a proviso in there. The rates of transfer compared to women having a home birth with no cesarean, compared to women having a planned HBAC or home birth after cesarean, they transfer into hospital more often than a woman with no previous cesarean. And that might be because, you know, midwives are being a bit more vigilant or a bit more aware of things that can happen, and, you know, do that transfer in. Some data from the US looked at neonatal morbidity and mortality, and that was slightly higher in babies born at home. Still pretty small, but it is still there. So I think if you're making those decisions, you've got to kind of look at that and then decide, is that something that you want to do? I think it's just much more complex than that. I think often the reason women have the decision to go home is because it's safer and they feel better than it is going to be in the hospital.
One of the things, Hazel, I wanted to ask throughout all of your research, what the most surprising element that you'd come across in your research regarding VBAC?
I think for me, looking at the research that I have done, I think the biggest aha moment I had was when I looked at the four factors and realised that women who planned a VBAC but had a repeat cesarean could still feel satisfied and still feel that they had a good birth experience if they had good experiences of those four factors. But that doesn't change my mind on how important I think VBAC is. So it's not to me as if to say, well, it doesn't matter what kind of birth experience you have as long as you've got those four factors in there. That's not what I'm saying. But what I did think was actually, yeah, it's, we can make, you can make a real difference when you're planning a VBAC Even if you have a repeat cesarean, if you have enough of those four factors, like if you feel like you were in control of your decisions, you had confidence in yourself and your healthcare providers, you had a good relationship, and you were as active as you could be in labor, then if you had a repeat cesarean at that point, that you could still feel very satisfied and complete with the decision that you made to have a repeat cesarean. I think that was something really important. And then I think throughout it, I just am continuously surprised at how poorly treated women planning a VBAC are. Like when I get those responses of, you know, 2/3 of women having a traumatic previous birth experience, and then over half of women receiving hurtful comments. Like that's the stuff that just, I think, just keeps fires me on. Like it just keeps me going, because that's disgraceful, and that is against the human rights, you know, that women shouldn't be treated like that. And I think I'm glad that continues to shock me, because that continues to drive me to change the way that women are treated when they're planning a VBAC.
So much to take away from this chat, Hazel. Thank you so much.
That's okay. Look, I have set up the little, I haven't done many videos for a while, I will admit, yeah. But the Hazel Kittle VBAC Researcher Facebook page, just where there's a couple of videos that I unpack some of the research that's out there about particular topics in little animations, and I will do more. I'm just busy writing away at the moment, and now my academic job is a bit full on right now with everything going on. But, you know, if there's a topic that women want me to look at, then, and I've got this recently, I've done a bit of a crazy, and in February I was all over the place with conferences, and midwives were coming to me and saying, can you do a video about this or that? So if there's something that women want me to look at, I can see what's out there. I'm happy to do that. I like doing them. I've actually had feedback from women who have actually used those videos in appointments shown an obstetrician, you know, my video on something, which I think that would be interesting. But they can't run out of the room. They're just stuck there looking at this phone watching this video, which I think is great. Use them. Use them for your own education, but also educate your healthcare providers on them as well. So, yeah, communicate with me on there. You can message me and I can put on more videos
We'll definitely put your page, link your page on the show description.
Yeah, we thank you just not only for your time today, but also for your hard work and research into what really is an important field for women, and often one that's quite overlooked. So I just wanted to thank you for dedicating your research to that for other women out there. It's actually quite important.
Thank you. It was life-changing having a VBAC myself, and I know it is for other women. I've done the research. I know that other women feel like that. And I think all women should be able to have that opportunity to be able to feel like they did after their VBACs.
Thanks for listening to this bonus episode of VBAC Birth Stories, where our special guests bring their expert knowledge to you. If you like the show, please subscribe and feel free to leave a review. If you would like to connect with us on social media, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Just search for VBAC Birth Stories. If you have a question or would like to express interest in coming on our show, please email us at vbacbirthstories@gmail.com.
VBAC Birth Stories is a podcast where we share women's lived experiences. Please be advised that it's not intended to replace medical advice. If you have any concerns at all during your pregnancy, please always speak to your healthcare provider.